Good morning again. It's still good to be with you. I'd like to begin by telling you a story. In the ancient Greek pagan religion, there was a deity known as Prometheus. Some of you might have heard that name before because there's a couple famous stories associated with this pagan deity. The most famous story having to do with Prometheus begins with him as sort of the creator of mankind. Allegedly, he molded man from clay. That might sound familiar to you. He molded man from clay, and from that point on sort of had a special relationship with humankind. Prometheus is known as the one who stole fire from the gods and gave it to humans. And there's another story about Prometheus, and he's getting ready to offer a sacrifice to Zeus, and he kills an animal, and he sort of does a little bit of trickery with it. He takes it, and he sets up one section of this sacrifice to look really good and appetizing and appealing, but it was actually just the bones of the animal. Nothing really good for sacrifice. And then he took the other section of the animal, and he made it look not so good. But that's where all the good stuff was. That's where the good fatty portions were. And he offered it to Zeus, and he said, well, which one do you want? And Zeus chose the one that looked good, but was actually just full of bones. And from that point onward, that was the pattern of sacrifice that the ancient Greeks did towards their gods. And so, of course, Zeus, not liking having gotten, he imposes a punishment on this deity known as Prometheus. Prometheus's punishment was to be tied to rocks on the peak of the Caucasus Mountains, and an eagle flew in every day and ate part of his liver. An eagle came in every day and ate part of his liver. But throughout the course of the night, Prometheus's liver would regenerate. It would grow back. And it's my understanding that that might actually be how the human liver functions. I'm not exactly sure, but I think it does have some regenerative properties, which is interesting. But the liver would grow back, so the next day the eagle would come again and eat his liver away again. And it would grow, the evil would come again and eat it. And so Prometheus was punished with this eternal punishment of the eagle coming, eating his liver, flying away, the liver regrowing, and the eagle coming back to do it all over again. That's led some that study this sort of thing to coin this phrase, new liver, same eagle. That sort of refers to situations where we keep trying and keep trying to do something, but the same thing just keeps coming and chipping away at us, knocking us down over and over again. And so some people that study this say, new liver, same eagle. Eventually, Prometheus was freed. The Greek hero Heracles, the Roman version is Hercules, came and broke him out of this bondage on top of the mountains, and he was let free of. The eagle has some interesting usages in the Bible. I think you all have been studying that for a while here. The eagle has some interesting usages in the Bible that I'm sure you know of. We know that the eagle is sort of referred to as, it seems to be used as the king of the air, or at least that's the way I interpret it. Maybe those that have been teaching about that here have a different take. Turn with me to Revelation, the fourth chapter. Revelation, the fourth chapter, this is John's vision. The throne room scene we have in chapter 4. The eagle is mentioned here. Revelation chapter 4, verse 7. The first living creature was like a lion, the second living creature like a calf, and the third living creature had a face like a man, and the fourth living creature was like a flying eagle. So what do we have? We have the king of the land beasts, the lion, the king of the jungle. We have the king of the domesticated animals, the ox. We have the king of all animals that was created and commanded to subdue them, man. And we have the eagle, the king of the air, the king of the flying creatures. For our purposes today, as a means of analogy, I'd like us to think about the eagle as being somewhat parallel to God. The eagle, if we think of it as sort of the king over the flying beast, we know that God is our king. So I think that analogy is somewhat apropos. And Prometheus, I'd like you to just think about him as representing the false pagan religions that characterize the ancient world and have characterized all of human history. He has a specific connection to mankind in his in the canon that has to do with him in Greek mythology. So I think it's appropriate that we use him to represent pagan religion and humans that have worshipped false gods. What do we really know the truth is? As I mentioned earlier this morning, these stories that come down to us from antiquity are myths. They're just that. There's no truth to them. They're stories. They were made up to entertain. Or in some cases to give a rationalization for something. A popular form of literature in the ancient Greek world is what we call etiologies. That's E-T-I-ologies. Etiologies, which basically just means origin story. And this story of Prometheus is the origin story of, firstly, mankind. Second, fire. And third, how humans sacrifice to gods, at least in the ancient Greek pattern. But these stories are just stories. I don't think there's anything to them more than, that's entertaining. Maybe. Sometimes. What do we really know about how mankind came to this earth and about what his history is? In the beginning, what? God created the heavens and the earth. Amen. In 6 days, he created everything that we see. And on the seventh day, he rested. Psalm 33, verse 6. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. Where does language come from? We don't really know that. People have studied that for decades now. Where does language come from? Where is the origin of this thing that we do where we look at one another and I make some weird vocalizations and you think about them and then you make some back? Scientists, scholars can't tell us that. But we know. Because how did God create? By the word of his mouth. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And it was good. That's the origin of language. Right there. In Genesis, the first chapter. We know that this was a collaborative effort within the Trinity, within the Godhead, as we know that Christ was involved in the creation process. John chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made. Colossians chapter 1. Colossians chapter 1, verse 16. For by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created through him and for him. You all know this, I think. Perhaps you don't. But what we're doing is what we talked about this morning. We're laying the foundation. We're laying the foundation of the knowledge that God has given us. God created. And he collaborated with his Son, the Word, and with the Holy Spirit. This is the first of two books or testimonies that God gave to man. The first testimony and book that God gave is the book of his work, specifically his creation. When you and I walk outside and we see the snow falling from the sky, or we see the flowers blooming, or we see one another, and we commune with one another. That, to me, is a book where we can read about God's creative power, and about what he's done, and about what he's fashioned. And I think that's a beautiful thing. Kenzie and I were driving up last night, and it started snowing on us. And she made the comment, well, it's pretty, it's not fun to drive in, but it's beautiful. The creation is a testimony of God's power, of what he's done for us. And later on, he would give a book in written form of his words and of his law. But the testimony of creation he gave to mankind first. This reminds me of a concept we find in 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter, starting with verse 46. However, the spiritual is not first, but the natural, and afterward the spiritual. The first man was of the earth, made of dust. The second man is the Lord from heaven. As was the man of the dust, so also are those who are made of dust. And as is the heavenly man, so also are those who are heavenly. And as we have borne the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly man. We know that God's creation and his plan follows this pattern of the natural, the physical, and then the spiritual. I apply that to this a little bit. Because man had God's natural work first, and then a couple thousand years later, he gave a written word to mankind. Of course, he was speaking to man throughout, but when Adam and Eve opened their eyes, they saw creation. And I think they probably heard God speaking to them not long after. But in this case, the natural, the physical world is still spiritual in a way. Not in the way that some cultures have worshipped the earth and worship the trees as being divine or being incarnations of something divine. But there's a part of God's creation that reflects what is divine, what is spiritual. Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And Romans chapter 1, verse 20, which Brother Ronnie read for us this morning, which I appreciate and thank him for. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that were made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. This book that we see around us, the book of creation that God has given us, it screams, God made me. I was fashioned by God. It's really beautiful, brothers and sisters, is it not? It's enough to take your breath away. This spiritual testimony of the book of creation was sufficient for those who did not have the written book. Romans chapter 1, verse 19, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. How did he show it? He showed it in his creation. He showed it in his creation. Romans chapter 2, starting with verse 14. For when Gentiles who did not have the law by nature do the things in the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them. This book of creation, the things that we see around us, for Gentiles that did not have the law, it was sufficient. It was enough to look around and to say, there's something greater. There's something outside of the here and now. There's something outside of the physical and the natural. And we have evidence of cultures, of Gentile cultures, who for thousands of years believed in one single creator, all-powerful, all-sovereign God. We have examples of this. There's an example of an Aboriginal tribe down in Australia, very isolated from the rest of the world, that for thousands of years practiced, worshipped, and believed in one single creator God. It was enough. It was sufficient to understand God, to know him, and to develop an understanding of some of what his expectations were. It was enough for not only a surface-level, lukewarm relationship, but one that could penetrate to the heart, that could penetrate to the conscience, that could penetrate and create a deep relationship with the divine. This was God's desire and intention for those who were not given his book of the law originally. Let's turn to Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17, I'll start reading in verse 26. And he has made from one nation from one blood, every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-apportioned times and the boundaries of their dwellings, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. He made mankind to dwell on the earth, to be in these places, to behold these wonders of creation, so that they could see those things and seek after God. Seek after what is divine. And seek after what is righteous. But we know that this was not the path that many Gentiles took. This was not the order that they subscribed to. So what did they do instead? We turn back to Romans chapter 1. This kind of gives us a roadmap of what happened. We see that in Romans chapter 1, verse 18, verse 25 and 28, they denied the truth, and they failed to keep the knowledge of God that had been revealed to them. They failed to acknowledge what God had revealed and to apply that to their lives, to live righteously before the Creator. It was plain and evident to them, but they suppressed it and rejected it. First of all, they suppressed the truth, we're told. They suppressed the truth. The interesting thing is, as you study these pagan religions and these mythologies, there are glimpses, little nuggets of truth, things that are close to the truth. I'll give you an example. I'm going to tell you about three popular pagan creation stories. I'll write them up on the board. I'm going to tell you about three popular pagan creation stories, and we'll talk about something from each one of them that's interesting. I thought I'd write those down in case anyone was interested in looking into them further. The first one is called the Enuma Elish. It's a Mesopotamian text. That word, those two words, Enuma Elish, mean when on high. Those are the first two Near Eastern words, the first three words in our language, when on high. That's what those mean. In the Enuma Elish, there are pre-existent gods, eternal gods, we might say, that create, that bring forth the earth, the people in it, from nothing. Pre-existent gods that bring forth the earth from nothing. The second one, Hesiod's Theogony. That word theogony refers to the origin story of a group of gods or divine beings. We also have cosmogonies, which refer to the origins of the universe. But Hesiod's Theogony is a popular ancient Greek creation myth. And it begins with a void that is called chaos, with, again, pre-existent gods from which come all other gods and beings. Finally, the Heliopolitan creation myth comes from Egypt. So we have three of the major cultures or culture groups of the ancient world. In the Heliopolitan creation account, we have a pre-existent god that is described like this. Look, infinity is subtracted from me. I am the remainder. That's really interesting. Infinity, eternity, is subtracted from me. I am the remainder. I'm left over. I made my members evolve through my effectiveness. I am the one who made me. I built myself as I wanted, according to my will. What came from me is under my supervision. Now, why do I share these things with you? Because they're patently false, some of them. As you read these, there's just some absurd things in them. Absurd, absurd things. But did you hear something in each one of those that just rang a little bell? That just sounded a little familiar? Pre-existent eternal gods? Creation from a void? All-powerful deities? There is some truth. Part of these is correct. God is eternal. So when time began, as we know it, he started it. And he had to exist outside of it. Humanity can keep tracking the beginning back and back as far as they can. But as these accounts show us, at some point you have to say, there was something here before there was something. This is the problem that skeptics of our age have to grapple with. The earth, we know, was without form and void. Without form and void. And that from this emptiness, God created everything. In fact, in the Enuma Elish, the Mesopotamian account, it says that the conditions of the pre-creation world were, quote, the waters. The waters, which is also used in Genesis chapter 1, verse 3. The Spirit was hovering over the face of the waters. But as we've already discussed, there's things that are wrong. These are largely incorrect, although they contain these nuggets of truth. You all know the myths, the stories, the legends, from whether they be books, movies, TV shows. You've heard of Hercules, Medusa, all these people that are popular. But they're false. They're false, although they contain some truth. How could they get to this place of truth? Well, it's interesting to me because we know that God placed eternity in our hearts. And when they looked around them, they could see certain things. The nature of God was evident to them in the creation, so they got some things right, and they got lots of other things wrong. In Romans chapter 1, verses 23 and 25, we see that they chose to worship what was created, the creature, rather than the creator. I think this is, it seems, reading through Romans chapter 1, the reason that they suppressed the truth, because they opted for the worship, of the creature. This takes a couple forms, as I see it. When I think, at least, about worshiping the creature, I imagine idols and these false graven images of animals. And that's certainly a reality. For example, Athens, the most popular ancient Greek city, is named after the goddess Athena, who is always, or not always, but is often represented with an owl. So these pagan deities had connections to animals. And throughout the Bible, we see examples of people worshiping images of animals and of bugs and of creeping things, of the heavenly hosts. So they worshipped creatures rather than the creator. But I think there's another aspect of this creature worship. And that is, they worshipped sinful and evil beings. The gods and deities of the Greek religion are the ones I'm most familiar with, so they're the ones I can best speak to. But those are no gods to be admired and worshipped. They're debased and immoral and evil and unrighteous. The false gods and goddesses of nearly every culture follow this pattern. They're not good. They're not right. They're not holy. They're evil. They fulfill the same works of the flesh that we see in Galatians chapter 5, verses 19 through 21, that are contrasted with the fruit of the Spirit. They practice the same worldly things that we see in 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. They are creatures, sinful and shortcoming, just the same way we are. And in that way, these pagan idols, these pagan gods, were mere reflections of humans. I understand that in psychology, there's this theory of cognitive dissonance. Does that sound familiar to anyone? My understanding is that when you believe something or you want something to be true, but you know somehow that reality is different, you either have to adapt your mindset to fix reality or adapt reality to fix, to agree with you. If there's somebody in there that's just horribly upset because I butchered that terribly, I'm sorry. But that's my very basic understanding of it. And that's what these people did. These Gentiles and these pagans from thousands of years were immoral, content in their sin. And so they took what is divine, what is holy, and what is good, and they modified it. They made it evil and immoral and unrighteous to make themselves feel better about the things they did. They did this to alleviate this sense of cognitive dissonance. Brothers and sisters, this has been going on for thousands and thousands of years. From the ancient Mesopotamians to the Akkadians, the Phoenicians, the Sumerians, the Assyrians, the Hittites, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Scandinavians, all of them have practiced false pagan polytheistic religion. Have you ever talked to a modern-day Hindu? A modern-day Hindu will tell you that they worship 330 million different gods. 330 million different gods. Anthropologists have identified around 18,000 gods that have been worshipped by humans throughout the millennia. But we know that out of that 18,000, 17,999 of them are false. But there is one Lord that is true. One Lord above all. And He has been working on mankind. He's been chipping away at mankind for thousands of years. So, we go from new liver, same eagle, to new gods, lowercase, same Lord. Throughout all those centuries, throughout all those millennia, there was one God that was there, that was saddened by what He saw and wanted something better for His creation. Three times in Romans chapter 1, we're told that God gave them up, God gave them up, and God gave them over to their vile, to their uncleanness, their vile passions, and their debased minds. These people wanted to worship immoral, evil, debased beings and practice such evil themselves. So eventually, God gave them what they wanted. And I think there's a lesson for us in that. Brothers and sisters, God is going to give you what you want. If you want to live a life apart from Him, ignoring Him, forsaking Him, He's going to let you do that. For this life, and by eternity, you'll have chosen what you want. You'll have demonstrated to Him what it is you choose. And He'll let you have it. But there was another option for these Gentile people, these pagans that worshipped the creature rather than the Creator. Acts chapter 17, Paul standing in Athens at the top of the Areopagus. The Areopagus is an outcropping of rock about a couple miles north and west of the Parthenon, the Acropolis. Acropolis, meaning above the city. The Acropolis can be viewed from anywhere in Athens. And on the top of it stood the Parthenon, constructed by the Athenian leader Pericles. And so as Paul is standing on the Areopagus, here in Acts chapter 17, right over his shoulder, or right behind the people, depending on which way he was standing, is the Acropolis and the Parthenon, the center of Athenian paganism. The center of paganism at that time in the known world. And what does Paul talk about to these Athenians? Paul says that these pagan gods are attempts. They're graspings to find the truth. They're a grasp at the one true God. They have this one monument set up to the unknown God. Paul says, I can see that you're searching for what's true. I can see that you are searching for what is right. And Paul starts to tell them about this one true God. This God does not dwell in temples made with hands like those that the Greeks and the other pagans worshipped. In fact, in Egyptian mythology, gods actually lived in temples. That's it. They lived in the temples, so the common man was not allowed to go into these temples. Only the Egyptian priests were allowed to go in. But this God does not dwell in temples made with man's hands. He does not need us to build Him something so He can sit and be comfy and be well taken care of. He is above all and in all and the Creator of all. He does not require man's favors to be appeased. This was a big, big part of Greek religion. You would come when you were getting ready to go to war, or to do something, or to build a house, or to harvest your crop, or to plant your crop, you would come to an altar, to a temple, and you would make an offering, or a sacrifice, or a libation, and say, here's a favor for you, Now how about you do me a favor? That's how Greek religion functioned. But this God does not require man's favors to be appeased and to be happy. Paul says that this God is not like mankind, shaped by arts and man's devisings. He is not like the gods that mankind has come up with. Rather, Paul says, he calls all men to repentance. He is not a God that is just a reflection of human nature, that's just as evil and debased and immoral as mankind is, but he is righteous and holy and good. And he desires that man would live the same way. And finally, Paul tells them, on the last day, he will judge all mankind according to the pattern ordained by the Son who he sent for us, selfless and loving. The guarantee of this judgment is the fact that he raised his Son from the dead, as he will do for us that follow him. In every single factor, in every single point, this message that Paul gives is totally different than what the pagans held to be true. It was higher, it was better, and it was holy. We have some modern applications for us today. God is calling you. God is calling you, no matter what new sin, no matter what new unrighteousness, no matter what new thing the world thinks up, the same Lord is calling and waiting for you. Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12, starting with verse 25. See that you do not refuse him who speaks. For if they did not escape he who refused him who spoke on earth, much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him who speaks from heaven, whose voice then shook the earth. But now he has promised, saying, yet once more I shake not only the earth but also heaven. Now this, yet once more, indicates the removal of those things that are being shaken, as of things that are made, that the things which cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace, by which we may serve God acceptably, with reverence and with fear. Brothers and sisters, you and I have not come to the mountain that may be touched and that burned with fire, and to blackness and darkness and tempest, and the sound of a trumpet and the voice of words, that those who heard it begged that the word should not be spoken to them anymore, for they could not endure what was commanded. But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the General Assembly and Church of the Firstborn who are registered in heaven, to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect, to the blood, to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling, which speaks better things than that of Abel. We've been called out of the things of this world, brothers and sisters. God is calling you out of your sinful state and is calling you to repentance. Revelation chapter 3, verses 20 and 21. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him, and he with me. To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. God is calling you today. Brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, do not resist him. Do not rely on the things of this world, on your own devices, or on the things that others may offer you. Rely on him only, forever. If you'd like to be baptized, putting your faith in him, or if there's anything else this group can do for you at this time, we invite you to come forward as we stand and as we sing the song of invitation.